Quantum field theory for cosmology, that's our course. Up on this part, I will always post updates. For example, if I'm at a conference and somebody else teaches or something like this, I will let you know. Also, there will be spring break sometime in February. I will post that there. If, as sometimes may happen, we have to move to another room because there's a conference or something, then again, I will post it there. I will also try to email it, all of you, which is why it is important that you fill your name and your email address legibly in this sheet. Those of you who would like to attend the course but not take it for credit, you're very welcome to do so. But please do me a favor and sign up for audit. Because in this way, you count. And then it's just that the higher ups in the university see that there's interest in the course, and then it will be offered again.
How do you do that? You know how to do that?
How to sign up for audit?
Yeah.
No, not sure.
No.
Do you know those people that can give you permission numbers? They are the people who can tell you.
Okay.
What did you say?
The grad advisor?
Grad advisor, yeah. Yeah, or the administrative assistants for grad studies in your department, if it's applied math or physics. They know that sort of thing. Yeah, and what it means is that you have absolutely no obligations. Right? It will show up in your transcript as having audited with AUD, but no numerical grade. It doesn't enter into anything. Okay, so this course is going to be taught twice a week, Tuesdays and Fridays, right? And always in this room, unless we are told we have to move because of a conference. On this homepage, I'm posting the lecture notes of when I last taught it 2 years ago. Now, this may change, and therefore, I'm updating a little bit always. So, therefore, I will post the latest ones on this site. I will also keep the old ones there. So, don't worry too much if you can't make it to some of the lectures. Let's say if you have a flu or so, don't come in and sneeze at everybody. Just make use of the fact that the lectures are being recorded and the lecture notes are available here too. I will also post a link to the recordings. The subject of this course is quantum field theory. Now, you need to know that quantum field theory comes in two flavors. Two kinds of quantum field theory. There's quantum field theory for particle physics. And then there's quantum field theory to do with gravity. And we do the gravity one. I will later today tell you more about the difference between the two. And I definitely recommend that you study both. They're both very important, but they address very different things. It's the same theory, it's just applied very differently. In the case of quantum field theory for particle physics, it's all about bosons and fermions, symmetries, local symmetries, gauge principles, spontaneous symmetry breaking, the symmetry breaking through anomalies, and renormalization. It's all very important. But and none of that comes up in quantum field theory for cosmology or for gravity. There, other questions come up. And I think they're just as important. For example, the question of what is a particle at all. This is something that we study in this course, for example. The Andrew effect demonstrates that the very notion of a particle, of matter, is actually quite non-trivial and quite different from what one might think on the basis of quantum field theory for particle physics. Then another question that comes up in quantum field theory for gravity and cosmology in our course is whether nature can destroy information. Obviously, we can burn a book, and that would seem to destroy the information. But let's remember that the time evolution, the quantum mechanical time evolution is unitary, and unitaries are always invertible. So even though the book's burned, in principle, it should be possible to run the evolution backwards. And in other words, actually the information hasn't been destroyed, it just has been scrambled. But there is a possibility that black holes, for example, might interrupt this. Might be non-unitary evolution. That's a question that comes up in quantum field theory on curved space-times. And then there is another little question, which is, where did it all come from? Cosmology. Quantum theory of cosmology. And what's the origin of the Big Bang, and what's the origin of structure in the universe? And it turns out that quantum field theory on curved space-times has a lot to say about that. The current standard model of cosmology is no less exciting than the current standard model of particle physics. And that's the topic of our course today this term. This, by the way, is an image of the cosmic microwave background. The colors indicate the temperature as a function of the angle in the sky, and those lines indicate the polarization, the predominant polarization of the light in various places in the sky. And I'm putting that there because this is having a lot of promise. In principle, if we could measure this polarization map much more accurately, as is indicated here, this is an actual measurement, but if we could measure it much more accurately, and if we could then extract from this vector field of polarization the curl and the gradient part. Remember, you can decompose a vector field into a curl and into a gradient. And the curl part could tell us about quantum gravity phenomena, about quantum gravitational waves. There was a false alarm already with the BICEP 2 experiment where they thought they had measured it, but unfortunately it was some contamination in the foreground, in the galactic foreground. But it's not excluded that eventually we might get a handle on this and a clear view outside the galaxy. We measure this polarization accurately and we might actually get a handle on such quantum gravitational measurements. This would, to be more accurate, it would be an indirect measurement of gravitational waves caused by quantum fluctuations, not by the collapse of a black hole or by the collision or inspiraling of black holes, but instead by quantum fluctuations. Okay, coming back to the infrastructure of this course, there's going to be, I think, 24 lectures in this course. There won't be homework or midterms or final exams. Instead, there's going to be a project. And the project is going to be about calculating and simulating quantum fluctuations, both in Minkowski space and in expanding space-times. This is super important because we currently believe, on the basis of the standard model of particle physics, of cosmology, that it was quantum fluctuations of fields, in particular the inflaton field and the metric, which during the initial stages of inflation in the universe were ripped to huge sizes, where they then seeded the condensation of hydrogen into galaxies and stars. So quantum fluctuations of fields, we can calculate accurately. We can also measure the distribution of matter in the universe, and the two match pretty well. So the project is going to be about quantum fluctuations, how to calculate them, how to visualize them on Minkowski space and on expanding space-times, or perhaps, if you so wish, in other backgrounds like black hole backgrounds, and then study and play around with them. How does the picture change if you go to lower dimensions, to higher dimensions? What if you have not massless fields, but massive fields? You know, play around with these things. I will post on this homepage of our course more details about what's expected in the project in a few weeks. And then the deadline for submitting the project, a write-up of something between 10 and 20 pages or so, is on the 19th of April, which is pretty much the latest I can make it. Okay, are there any questions about the formalities? If you came late and you haven't signed your email address in the sign-up sheet there, please do so, so that I can reach you. Okay, so if there are no questions, then let's dive right into it. Let me start with a historical background. A quick historical background. In the late 1800s, and then let's say around the year 1900, classical mechanics became untenable. It became clear because of experimental evidence that classical mechanics is no good fundamentally. It was still very useful for engineering, but it became clear that it's not the truth. And there were several reasons for this. In particular, around the year 1900, I think it was in the year 1900, that the first relatively accurate measurements of black body radiation were performed, particularly of the ultraviolet part of the spectrum of black body radiation, just the heat radiation emitted by some object. And it was a nice curve that if you draw the energy of the heat radiation over the frequency of the heat radiation, then you get it goes up like this and then it decays like that. But classical electromagnetism predicted something very different. It predicted that the higher the frequency, the higher the intensity of the radiation, which is nonsensical. Well, or let's just say that can't be our universe, because it would mean that everything radiates so much heat away at such a high rate, it's basically cooling down to zero temperature immediately. And the nowadays we understand what the problem was. The problem was a fundamental problem of classical theory, which is that in classical mechanics, you have the equipartition principle, which says that every degree of freedom gets 1/2 kT of energy in thermal equilibrium. But if you have arbitrarily short wavelengths, then every wavelength has its own harmonic oscillator, and there is an infinite number of these harmonic oscillators. And in fact, there are way more short frequencies than there are short wavelengths, high frequencies, than there are short ones. Because if you think of phase space or momentum space, the volume, if you're far out in the radius, it's much bigger than close by, close to the origin. So there's a momentum space volume factor in there. So therefore, if every harmonic oscillator of every mode acquired 1/2 kT of the electromagnetic field in thermal equilibrium, then you would expect that the shorter wavelengths would have very high amounts of energy in them. So the situation is we have some object, like a potato, and we have around it electromagnetic field, and they equilibrate, thermal equilibrium, and then the short wavelengths would all have 1/2 kT, all wavelengths would have 1/2 kT. In other words, the electromagnetic field would suck up very efficiently all sorts of energy, any amount of energy from that object, like a potato. That's what is called the ultraviolet catastrophe, and we now understand how it is avoided. It is avoided by quantum mechanics violating the equipartition principle. It's not the case that every harmonic oscillator gets a kT of energy. And that's because the energy spectrum of a harmonic oscillator is discretized. If the temperature is so low that it doesn't suffice, that the typical energies because of that temperature are not high enough to lift the harmonic oscillator from its ground state to its first excited state, well, then it just stays in its ground state. Whereas in a classical harmonic oscillator, it would get excited a little bit, but not a quantum harmonic oscillator. Once you have too little energy to even lift it to its first excited state, it just stays in its ground state. That violates equipartition, and that means that the ultraviolet catastrophe is avoided. And the really short wavelengths, the really high frequencies, with the large energy gaps in harmonic oscillators, don't get excited as much as they would be classically. Okay, but they didn't know that in the year 1900. But they knew that classical theory could not work. Classical electromagnetism, together with classical statistical mechanics, couldn't account for the actual spectrum of blackbody radiation. Then there was the photoelectric effect, the phenomenon that whether or not light can ionize a material depends not so much on the intensity of the light, but on the color of the light. Now we understand why that is, because it's the color that determines the energy of the individual photons. But they didn't know that then. And then, of course, there was the issue of the stability of matter. Rutherford and others had figured out that there are electrons around nuclei. But why would they not just crash into the nucleus? Because a charge that's accelerated should radiate, therefore lose energy, and therefore fall towards the nucleus, and that would be that, a catastrophe. Because in principle, if you have two charges that get arbitrarily close, they can go arbitrarily deep down into the potential, negative energy, and all that energy would then be radiated out because of energy conservation, and the explosion could destroy the universe. There is no limit to how much energy you can extract by bringing a positive and a negative charge arbitrarily close to each other. Now, that is saved by quantum theory too, because of the uncertainty principle. The electron cannot get too close to the proton, because if it's too close, if delta x is too small, it's confined to a very small space, then its delta p is large, which means it has enough momentum to escape from the proton again. And that's what determines the lowest Bohr orbit. All of these things were not clear yet in 1900. So in 1900, it was clear classical theory is not tenable. But then in 1925, so for about 25 years, they were struggling with this. Then in 1925, Heisenberg discovered the first formulation of non-relativistic quantum mechanics. And in essence, what he found was this. By the way, he was suffering of hay fever, and he was on some island in the North Sea to escape from the pollen, from the plants. And so he had absolutely nothing to do because it was a super boring island, and figured out quantum mechanics while escaping from hay fever. So what he figured out is that you can go from classical to quantum mechanics and solve these problems there by keeping the equations of motion the same. For example, for the harmonic oscillator, that's the equation of motion before and after quantization. It's the same thing, but you now have to assume that the x and the p, or the x and the mx dot, are no longer commuting, but instead you have, on the right-hand side, ih bar times the identity operator. Okay. Now, usually the mass is not time-dependent, so we can write p as mx dot. Now, a few months after Heisenberg, Schrödinger came up with the Schrödinger equation. And at first it looked very different, but it was also very successful. And then a few months later, Dirac showed that the two formulations were actually the same, and they just differed by going from the Heisenberg to the Schrödinger picture and vice versa. It's just a unitary transformation in between them. Another thing that was different superficially is that Schrödinger worked, of course, in a position representation or momentum representation, whereas Heisenberg typically worked in the representation of the eigenbasis of the Hamiltonian, let's say, of the harmonic oscillator or the hydrogen atom. And so the two formulations looked very different, but for reasons that we now understand are very easy. The time evolution was different by the time evolution picture being either the operators evolving in time or the states evolving in time, and the representation choice was also different. Position and momentum representation versus energy representation. So they look different, but Dirac figured it out within a few months. Now, quantization implied fundamental changes, of course. Mathematically, the fact that the position as a function of time and the momentum as a function of time were no longer commuting, meant, of course, that these functions of time, the position and the momentum as functions of time, could not be number valued anymore. They used to be number valued or vector valued, right? So x1, x2, x3 as a function of time. But the coefficients were number valued. This could no longer hold. They would have to be something else that's non-commutative. But what could they be? And objects that are non-commutative were, of course, known. And the obvious examples would be matrices. Matrices are generally not commutative. So the question arose, could it be that we can find a concrete representation of these commutation relations, concrete instances of these commutation relations, in terms of matrix-valued functions of time? Could it be that the position is no longer a number-valued function of time, but a matrix-valued function of time? And similarly with the momentum. And then if we just arrange the matrix entries in the right way, then maybe we get the commutation relations holding. Well, a first attempt would be to do this with finite dimensional matrices. But can that work? Let's see. If x hat of t and p hat of t are matrix valued functions, then let's take the trace of that equation here. Let's take the trace on the left. Let's take the trace on the right. If you arrive late, please make sure to sign in to that sheet there, you as well. Make sure I can read your email address. All right, so let's try this. And what do we find? We find that the trace of the left-hand side is the trace of a commutator of two matrices. But remember that the trace of AB is the trace of BA. So therefore, the left-hand side is zero. The trace of a commutator of matrices is zero. But what do we get on the right-hand side? Yeah, we get the trace of a multiple of the identity matrix. So we get IH bar times the dimension of the Hilbert space. So then what we would get is that 0 equal to IH bar times n, n being the dimension of the vector space. So that cannot work. We can try to go to higher and higher dimensions, but that just makes it worse. We get 0 equal to IH bar n. So we can't do it with matrices. We must have that the x hat of t and p hat of t are mathematically objects for whom the trace is not well defined. Because if it is, that argument kills it. So we can achieve this by working in infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. And infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, we can have that the left and the right hand side are not defined. And then with a little luck, we can actually arrange for these commutation relations to hold. And as we will see, that of course works. And we can get representations with infinite dimensional matrices, which is what Heisenberg at first did. He worked in the energy basis, and he got for the X and the P and the Hamiltonian matrices, but they were infinite by infinite matrices. Otherwise, you would have run into this. Right, another mathematical consequence, physical consequence of the non-commutativity of the X and the P. This was a mathematical implication of it. And the physics implication of it is, of course, that we have the uncertainty principle. And the uncertainty principle tells us, of course, that there are quantum fluctuations. Typically, we have fluctuations in X and fluctuations in P. If you make the one small, the fluctuations in the other must be large. And so statistical uncertainty is seen as a part of nature. It's no longer just the fault of engineers and imperfect experimenters that there are uncertainties. No, uncertainties can be there for fundamental reasons. I'm reviewing all of those things because very analogous things happen for quantum field theory. Of course, you know it already for quantum mechanics, but for quantum field theory, similar things happen. So how did it happen that non-relativistic quantum mechanics had to be upgraded And how did it happen that we eventually arrived at quantum field theory? So non-relativistic quantum mechanics was discovered in 1925. Heisenberg, Schrödinger, Dirac. And this is the essence of it. And very quickly, within just a few years, it became clear that this is not the true thing. This is not describing nature accurately. It became unsatisfactory. And the reason is that it's not consistent with special relativity. And special relativity is important, even in the hydrogen atom already. And even more so in heavier atoms. Why is that? Well, take, for example, the hydrogen atom and look at the electron in its ground state. You can calculate what a typical momentum is of such an electron. If you perform the momentum measurement on an electron in the ground state of the hydrogen atom, and then you take that typical momentum and divide it by the mass of the electron, you get a typical velocity in quotation marks. Of course, it's not really moving with such a velocity, but it just gives you an indication. It turns out that that velocity is about 1% of the speed of light. Well, actually, it's 1 over 137 of the speed of light. Now, you might say, OK, that's a really small perturbation. But yeah, we should expect that there is a deviation between what quantum mechanics tells us about the spectra of the hydrogen atom and what is really found on the basis of taking into account relativity. And 1% accuracy is nothing in spectroscopy. Even then, 100 years ago, they were quite capable of measuring spectra with more accuracy than 1%. So it was clear that relativity had to be built into quantum mechanics. So that launched attempts to find a covariant generalization of the Schrödinger equation. And that led to the Dirac equation, and it led to the Klein-Gordon equation. And we will deal a lot with the Klein-Gordon equation later in the course, but let's here mention also the Dirac equation. Now, some things could be done with the Dirac equation and the Klein-Gordon equation, but they had serious problems. In particular, the energy spectrum was not bounded from below. If you work with the Klein-Gordon equation or the Dirac equation. And you can view it this way. In the Klein-Gordon equation, you have that, that will stop at some point. See, you can write the Schrödinger equation as p naught equal to p vector squared over 2m. And then that would be the Schrödinger equation. That is the relationship between energy and momentum in non-relativistic theory. But then the Klein-Gordon equation would be p naught squared minus p vector squared equal to m squared c to the fourth. Now, you can write this as p naught equal to p vector squared, or let's put it this way, m squared c to the fourth plus p vector squared, and a square root. And if you expand this, this is going to be mc squared plus p vector squared over 2m plus higher order in p vector squared squared. So on one hand, you see that if you go from the Schrödinger equation to the Dirac equation, you see you just replaced the p naught goes into I d by dt, the p goes into minus I h bar d by dx, I, that's an h bar. Then this becomes the Schrödinger equation here. And here, if you plug the same definitions for pi and p naught into the Klein-Gödel equation, you get, I mean, into this form of the Klein-Gödel equation, you get the Klein-Gödel equation as a differential equation. But also you can solve the Klein-Gödel equation in this way. For p naught, you get the square root, and you get E equal mc squared as the leading term, and then you get that part. Now, this is a constant. And as a constant, it makes no difference in the Schrödinger equation. If you add to this plus E naught, which turns out to be mc squared, it doesn't affect the dynamics at all. Because in classical, in non-gravitational theory, the absolute value of the energy never matters. It's only changes of the energy. But, and this is the problem I wanted to allude to here, strictly speaking, I have to write here plus minus. Because this has a positive root and a negative root. And then we have to ask, what about the negative root? You see, for whatever we find for the positive energies, we also find for the negative energies. But if the energy spectrum of a Hamiltonian is not bounded from below, it means that the system could go to lower and lower energetic states while emitting the energy that it drops down, right? So it drops down in energy, and the difference is it emits. And again, it's an explosion. If the hydrogen atom had a Hamiltonian that wasn't bounded from below, it could emit arbitrary amounts of energy while going into a negative energy hole. So the universe wouldn't be stable then. So that was a fundamental problem. And then the Dirac equation came along, trying to solve this by linearizing the problem here. So instead of, you see, this cannot be covariant because it's linear in p naught and quadratic in p vector. Cannot possibly be invariant under Lorentz transformation. Klein and Gordon's answer was to take this equation, which is quadratic in p naught and quadratic in p vector. That is covariant. It's invariant under Lorentz transformations. But Dirac, of course, also found a way to get a covariant equation with p naught and p vector both occurring linearly. It's kind of the square root of the Klein-Gödel equation, as we will later see in the course. But as it turns out, that too didn't solve the problem. There were also negative energy solutions. With the Dirac equation and Klein-Gödel equation, it wasn't clear what happened to the unitarity of time evolution. Is the time evolution still unitary? And certain processes that had been observed could not be described by just the Dirac equation or the Klein-Gödel equation. For example, the creation and the annihilation of particles. You can take an electron and a positron and have them annihilate each other, and then two photons come out. You can't describe that with the Dirac equation or with the Klein-Gödel equation. Think of the Schrödinger equation. It only explains how one particle evolves, or maybe how n particles evolve. You can also write down an n-particle Schrödinger equation. But it never tells you how the number of particles would change. And the same is true for the Klein-Gödel equation or the Dirac equation. They don't account for the creation and annihilation of particles. But these processes had been observed, so it was clear that the Dirac equation and Klein-Gödel equation were not the solution. And when I say Dirac equation and Klein-Gödel equation, I mean the first quantized Dirac equation and Klein-Gödel equation. So you just take other differential equations other than the Schrödinger equation. But first quantized, not quantum field theory. So they had these problems. And then Heisenberg and others came along with a fresh idea, which led to quantum field theory. And that was the idea of second quantization. It's disputable whether the original motivation is still a good motivation, but it's good to know anyway how they found quantum field theory. So the idea of second quantization is this one. Heisenberg and others looked at quantum mechanics, and they said, quantum mechanics tells us that everything in nature is fluctuating, positions have uncertainty, momenta have uncertainties, energies have uncertainties. Typically, they are fluctuating. Unless if you are in an eigenstate of an observable, you're going to have necessarily some quantum fluctuations in that observable. So nature wants to quantum fluctuate. Except the wave function doesn't. And they said, how weird is this? Quantum mechanics says that everything is subject to quantum fluctuations except for one thing. And that's the wave function itself. You see, Heisenberg said, look, if you know the position and the momentum of something with some accuracy at initial conditions, then classical mechanics would tell you what they evolve into in a deterministic way. But quantum mechanically, there's always uncertainty about this. Fluctuations, even if you have as good knowledge as is possible at the beginning. And then they said, except for wave functions. Wave functions basically still behave classically in quantum mechanics. Because if you know the initial wave function of a Schrödinger wave, then you can calculate using the Schrödinger equation what this wave function looks like at the later point in time. There is no fluctuations in this. You have the wave function at the initial point of time, and then you can just propagate it forward and get the wave function later. No fluctuations in it. And then they said, how weird. Shouldn't the wave function too be subject to fluctuations? So they thought, let's try that. The idea of second quantization was, let's quantize psi, the wave function itself, in a way similar to how they had succeeded with first quantization. In first quantization, they said, OK, look at the momentum. It's basically x dot up to the mass, but the mass is not time dependent. So we might just set it to 1, let's say, in suitable units. So in first quantization, we have that the momentum, which is just a time derivative of the position, doesn't commute with the position. So the degree of freedom is the position, and its time derivative doesn't commute with it. And so they said, if we want to quantize the wave function, psi, then let's look at its time derivative. So we put a dot over it, and then that plays the same role as the x dot takes in quantum mechanics. So it's kind of a momentum field. So if the wave function of the quantum field is psi, then psi dot is kind of the momentum associated to it. And then, similar to the requirement of the canonical commutation relations in first quantization, that x and x dot don't commute, but instead close into IH bar times the Kronecker delta. Then similar to that, we now require that the wave function and its momentum, which is just its time derivative, also should not commute. There's a bit of a subtlety. You see, in first quantization, we have several degrees of freedom, namely the position operators, x1, x2, x3. And each one of them has its time derivative. And each degree of freedom is non-commutative only with its momentum. That's why we have the Kronecker delta on the right-hand side. And so they said, with a field, we don't just have 3 degrees of freedom. We have uncountably many degrees of freedom. We have psi of x. We have, for every x, we have a degree of freedom, the amplitude of the field. So they said, for every x, we have a psi of x, a degree of freedom, and its momentum, which is psi dot of x, for every fixed x. And then they said, let's require that the psi at some x doesn't commute with the psi dot of the same x. But it should commute with the momenta of the other values, the other places. So they put on the right-hand side a Dirac delta of x minus x prime, because that's the continuum analogon of the Kronecker delta ij of these degrees of freedom. So then what they had is the wave function here, the momentum of the wave function there, and these canonical commutation relations. This, it turns out, even though it was a super weird proposal, did actually work out and was the start of quantum field theory. And it turned out that with these ansatz, you can ensure that the Hamiltonian that you get has positive energy only, or it's that its spectrum is bounded from below. You can restore unitarity, and so on. All of those things we will, of course, address in this course. I'm just giving you a quick historical overview here. Of course, we will do everything very carefully later in the course. So what are the consequences then of this assumption? That for the wave function, you have to introduce a canonically conjugate momentum wave function and then impose this non-trivial commutator between them. Well, first of all, psi and pi can no longer be number valued. They used to be complex number valued, right? The probability amplitudes, position wave function. But clearly, being non-commutative, they can no longer be number valued. They will have to be matrix valued or operator valued. And so if we look at the psi hat of x and t, then if we choose a particular x and a particular t, then this has to be some kind of infinite by infinite matrix or operator in Hilbert space. And the overall procedure of second quantization was then, let's keep the equations of motion the same, just like we did in first quantization, like the harmonic oscillator equation, the hydrogen atom equations of motion, all of those equations of motion were kept the same, but we required the canonical commutation relations. And so similarly now for the wave function, you keep the equation of motion the same, but you impose this non-trivial canonical commutation relation between psi and psi dot. Now that meant that you also get a kind of uncertainty principle between the uncertainty in psi and the uncertainty in psi dot. This we will have to do much more carefully, because obviously on the right-hand side, we have either zero or an ill-defined number or infinite number there. We will actually have to smear this over some space-time region for this to make sense. But intuitively, that's something that we should expect to get. And then also let me make a comment about something pretty fundamental here. Second quantization, a priori, has nothing to do with relativity. It didn't come up yet. All we did is we said that the Schrödinger equation of first quantization is weird because first quantized theory says that everything fluctuates except for the wave function. So we try to make the wave function fluctuate as well. So we take the psi of x and consider psi dot of x as well, and then insist that there's a non-trivial commutator between psi and psi dot. And then we said, we keep the equations of motion the same, as we always do when we quantize. We keep the equations of motion the same. We just add these non-trivial commutation relations. But what does that mean here a priori? It means we keep the Schrödinger equation the same. Right? We would still have the same Schrödinger equation as before, because the same equation of motion holds. We're just imposing these non-trivial canonical commutation relations on top of that. And so what you obtain in this way is non-relativistic second quantization, a non-relativistic quantum field theory. That was the first quantum field theory. It didn't help with the accuracy of the predictions at first, because you didn't get any relativistic effects in there. You didn't get the lowest energy gap in the hydrogen atom any more accurate in this way, because you didn't build in any relativity. But you got some benefits. For example, you could now calculate creation annihilation processes, and it turns out that you get a Hamiltonian which has a bounded spectrum, and unitarity will be fine, and so on. But relativity isn't built in yet. Let's just keep that apart. Later we will see how we can then get relativity. It's basically this way, that we keep the philosophy of second quantization, which is the non-trivial commutation relations between psi and psi dot, but the equation of motion, which used to be the Schrödinger equation for psi, that we make covariant. For example, the Klein-Gordon equation or the Dirac equation. So we consider the Dirac equation or the Klein-Gordon equation and keep those equations of motion, those relativistic equations of motion, while imposing the non-trivial commutation relations between psi and psi dot. And that then gets us to relativistic quantum field theory. So we can now predict and describe new phenomena with second quantization. In particular, second quantized theory allows us to describe particle creation and annihilation. Why is that intuitive that that would come up in second quantization? But remember what we do in second quantization. We say that the wave function is no longer number valued, it's operator valued. But remember that the wave function in first quantization was complex number valued, and we required that the norm is 1. Clearly, we can no longer insist on that, because now it's an operator valued field. Which means that at best we get an approximation to the norm being 1, but there's going to be fluctuations. Therefore, we should expect that there's going to be fluctuations of particle number. And in fact, it's more than fluctuations in particle number. You can also describe creation and annihilation of particles. Also, we get a resolution to the issue of the negative energy spectrum in the Hamiltonian. It turns out that what used to be the negative energy solutions that led to an unstable theory because in first quantization, because it would allow the system to drop to arbitrarily low energies, that in quantum field theory resurfaces differently, namely as the existence of antiparticles. What in first quantizations are states of negative energy, in second quantizations are states of positive energy describing antiparticles. I'm just rushing through things in a preview very quickly here. Okay, now regarding fields, there's also something new. Namely, now that we have that the field and its canonically conjugate field psi dot obey non-trivial commutation relations, we know that we should expect fluctuations in the field amplitude, just like we should expect fluctuations in the position operator. For example, in first quantization, where we have the non-trivial commutation relations and therefore uncertainty principle between x and p. If we look at, for example, the ground state of a harmonic oscillator, and we know that even in the ground state, where the expectation value of the position operator is 0, if you measure the position, you will find it fluctuate around 0. Delta x is larger than 0. Now, in second quantization, the same thing should happen for fields. Fields are also obeying harmonic oscillator-like equations, as we will see in great detail in this course. Quantum fields are basically consisting of a lot of harmonic oscillators that are coupled to each other. And if you look at the ground state of these coupled harmonic oscillators, they will have uncertainties, in particular uncertainties in the fields. So what we will find is that even when we are in the ground state of all the field oscillators, a state that we will later call the vacuum state. Even if the system is in a vacuum state and the expectation value of the field is 0, then still, if you actually went out there and measured the amplitude of the field, if you could measure that with a suitable instrument, you would not expect the field to be vanishing everywhere. Even in the lowest energy state, it wouldn't. Instead, what you would typically find is something like that, a pattern of quantum fluctuations of the field. If you have a box that you completely close and you keep the walls at 0 temperature, then you would expect that it's very dark in there. There should not be any electromagnetic field in there because it's a box. No field gets in there and since the walls are at zero temperature, there shouldn't be any heat radiation. So you should really have the vacuum in there. And still, if you went there and measured the electric field or the magnetic field, you should see fluctuations of it. Also, if you're in the box, look for electronic wave functions or whatever fields it might be, there should always be fluctuations. And we will soon see in the next few lectures how exactly to calculate things like this. And to explore how this picture changes in other dimensions, how the fluctuations depend on masses, how the fluctuations depend on the expansion or shrinkage of space-time. Okay, so quantum field theory is second quantization, or arose from the idea of second quantization. I have to say that while this is the historical background for second quantization, most textbooks nowadays jump right into second quantization without really going much into the history of it, and then they might not call it second quantization, they might just call it quantum field theory, but you know, that's the origin of it. Now, quantum field theory, or second quantization, has two main areas of application, as we discussed at the very beginning today. There is the application of quantum field theory to the standard model of particle physics, quarks and electrons and neutrinos and photons and W and Z bosons and so on. This is all super exciting because it describes how the matter that we are made of and that the universe is made of, how it behaves. Standard model of particle physics, quantum field theory as applied to the standard model of particle physics, describes the electromagnetic force, the weak force, the strong forces, and we use the tools of Feynman diagrams to describe the mathematics that goes on in there in an efficient way. We find exciting phenomena such as screening and anti-screening and renormalization. Just to give you a rough idea of this, you could have that an electron comes in and goes out again, and a quark comes in and a quark comes out again, and that they interact with each other. So you have an electron and a quark interacting with each other, right? So they come in like this, go out like that. But the interaction is non-trivial. They could be interacting by having a virtual photon emitted from both of them, which then explode into an electron-positron pair and then annihilate again, like this. All of this is just a manifestation of quantum fluctuations in the vacuum. And then you can have phenomena such as the electron here being charged, the quark over there also being charged. In the middle, you have an electron-positron pair. And since you have charges here, even though they're just virtual charges, they're not real charges in the sense that they're being observed by anybody, they're not coupling to anything else, these virtual charges still act as if they still act to give the vacuum here a polarization, polarizability. Basically, they give the vacuum a dielectric property. For example, if this is an electron and this is a positively charged quark, they would attract each other. But these, intuitively speaking, would arrange themselves such that the positron would be attracted a little bit to the electron, the electron would be attracted a little bit towards the positive quark, and in this way, you have that the attraction between the electron and the positive quark is actually a little bit shielded because you have this polarization going on in the middle between them. You would have that in a solid too. But amazingly, you also have it in the vacuum because these quantum fluctuations in the vacuum also can polarize the vacuum just in the same way that charges rearrange themselves in a crystal to provide polarization. And what this means is that the closer the electron and the positive charge are brought together, the more, the less of this is going on in between them, the further away you bring them, the more of this polarization goes on in between them. And so you have that, depending on how far they are apart from each other, their charges are screened from each other more or less, depending on whether more or less of this polarization goes on in between them. And that means that effectively, the coupling constant with which the charges couple to the fields is dependent on the distance between the two particles in question. These processes are studied in the discipline of renormalization, where you find that coupling constants and charges are running. They are not fixed. If you look up the mass of a quark, there is no such thing. If you look up the coupling constant of electromagnetism, there's no such thing. These are really functions rather than numbers. In large scales, usually it's a number that doesn't change much. This function is very flat. But if you go to very short distances, this stuff becomes very important. And then similarly, in quantum field theory as applied to particle physics, you study things like the Higgs process, Higgs phenomenon, whereby particles can acquire masses. And then there are phenomena such as anomalies. Anomalies are exciting things. Imagine you have an action or a Hamiltonian that displays a symmetry. Then it can happen that the classical theory with this Hamiltonian possesses this symmetry, but the quantum theory doesn't. And that's because the symmetry, intuitively speaking, might be confined to the surface in the space of evolutions, of classical evolutions. And then quantum fluctuations that take you away from that might not show that symmetry. So quantum fluctuations can break symmetries. A classical theory may have symmetries that the same theory quantized doesn't have. This phenomenon, or the avoidance of that phenomenon, guides much of the construction of the standard model of particle physics. So in other words, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on in quantum field theory as applied to particle physics. But that's not our topic. We are going to study the standard model of cosmology with quantum field theory. And you might wonder, is there anything interesting left to study? There is, I think. So here we are putting together classical general relativity and quantum field theory. At some point, we actually also quantize part of general relativity. That's part of the standard model of cosmology nowadays, that we also have to take into account quantum fluctuations of a certain part of the metric in order to account what we see. So it's mostly classical general relativity and quantum field theory, but in parts, we actually quantize GR here as well. We will also look into the effect of accelerations, because with the equivalence principle, there's a close connection between accelerations and gravity. So what we will study is the impact that acceleration has on quantum field theory, the impact that curvature has on quantum field theory, the impact of horizons on quantum field theory. And then we can address questions like these. What is a particle? Now, you may wonder, well, is that a difficult question? It turns out it's highly non-trivial, because you can arrange situations in which some observers would agree that there are no particles around, whereas other observers would say, whoa, there's so many particles around. Whether or not particles exist, whether or not detectors of particles click, can depend on your state of motion. It can depend on the state that the field is in. And that is exemplified in the Unruh effect that we will study in detail. Then, similarly, not only acceleration, as I said, the state of motion can determine this, and in particular, acceleration plays a role here. And of course, curvature can also lead to the production of particles. And in particular, in the Hawking effect, Hawking radiation from black holes, that you also study here, we will study Hawking radiation, and that is an important phenomenon because here the question comes up whether nature is able to destroy information. As we discussed at the beginning of the lecture today, if you burn a book, it appears to destroy the information, but if the evolution is unitary, in principle, it could be run backwards. So therefore, all the information about the book is still there in the gases, the smoke, and the ashes. And then we can ask, where did it all come from? What can quantum field theory combined with general relativity tell us about the Big Bang? And what can it tell us about the origin of the inhomogeneities in the universe? Classical general relativity combined with a scalar field that has a certain type of potential can explain why there might have been at the beginning of the universe a period of very rapid, almost exponential expansion. And that can account for a lot of weird phenomena that we see in the universe, such as, for example, that the universe is huge and flat. Why is it so flat? It could have any kind of curvature. Why is it that the cosmic microwave background over there has the same temperature as over there with very high accuracy, one part in a million? How come they have the same temperature here and there, even though these parts of the universe where that heat radiation comes from and that part of the universe where that heat radiation comes from never were in causal contact, apparently, if you just run it backwards in time? So a lot of things can be described just classically. But why is the universe so flat and has inhomogeneities? Namely, some pattern of distribution of galaxies, some pattern of the distribution of the heat radiation in the CMB. Where does that pattern come from? What kind of statistics is that? Now, there have been a number of theories about the origin of the distribution of galaxies, and the origin of the distribution of the original heat radiation in the cosmic microwave background. And one theory survived the measurement of these things with great accuracy, and that's cosmic inflation, which is a theory that holds that these inhomogeneities, the statistics of these inhomogeneities in the universe, matches the statistics of quantum fluctuations. So that's what, it's one of the main goals in this course, that we find out how to calculate quantum fluctuations of fields. We will find that normally these quantum fluctuations are of appreciable amplitude only and very, very short length scales. But when the universe expands very fast, then the universe can rip these quantum fluctuations that are normally of these large amplitude quantum fluctuations are normally only at very short wavelengths to enormously large, cosmologically large scales, where then they can seed the formation of structure in the universe, the condensation of hydrogen into galaxies and stars. And the amazing thing is that the statistics matches quite well between the predictions from quantum fluctuations of fields and the observations in the CMB and in the distribution of galaxies. So what is cosmic inflation all about? Overall the theory here, the picture? On this slide, I'm telling you two things that are relatively independent of another. One is experimentally pretty safe. It's accurate to, I mean, it's just very accurate. It actually matches, experiment and predictions match a certain measured curve of the statistics of the distribution of galaxies very accurately with very few free parameters. And the other is very speculative, but it's the most natural thing to conclude from the standard model of cosmology now. Let me start with the very speculative thing. According to the current standard model of cosmology, there is a scalar field, a Klein-Gordon field, second quantized in the universe, a so-called inflaton field, which may or may not be the same as the Higgs field. We don't know yet. And at any moment in time, this field is fluctuating, like any other field is fluctuating. But scalar fields have a particular feature. If they have a particular potential, V of phi, which doesn't have to be very complicated, something like phi squared or phi to the fourth would do, then the following can happen. The field might fluctuate as a fluke, such that on a scale, in a volume a few Planck lengths across, it has an energy that is almost reaching to the Planck energy. If that happens, then just because of general relativity, that elevated scalar potential will act temporarily as if there was a large cosmological constant locally. But this will lead, through the Einstein equations, to a large expansion locally. You can think of this as the universe spawning a mushrooming out daughter universe. Super unlikely, because a fluctuation would have to be several Planck lengths across, very high. So it's super unlikely to happen. But in a universe that's big enough, or even infinite, this is not an unlikely event. So a universe like ours appears to be able to spawn randomly daughter universes. Now, you shouldn't think of this as the created bubble pressing outwards on what the environment is. It just creates its own space. It's as if you took a trampoline with a rubber surface and you heated up some part of the rubber and you blow on it and then you create a bubble coming out. It doesn't disturb the rest of the trampoline. And then finally, this daughter universe could expand super quickly, very large, and then the fluctuation eventually comes to an end. You know, it just temporarily fluctuated. The field just temporarily fluctuated to very high energies on this Planck length, which then became a very high energy spread over a huge volume. And then that energy goes into something. And it goes into the production of all sorts of particles. And that then looks like a Big Bang. So basically, a Big Bang can be triggered by a quantum fluctuations in a mother universe spawning a daughter universe. It appears that with the current standard model of cosmology, this is kind of unavoidable as a possibility. We don't know whether that is very likely, because it depends on how big the universe is. It might be a closed universe and might not be very likely to occur. But in principle, our universe is not stable in that sense. It can produce these daughter universes, which then themselves can produce daughter universes, and so on. But independently now of whether that is the origin of a Big Bang, of this exponential expansion of this bubble, if there is an exponential expansion of an initial bubble, independently of whether it comes from a mother universe or not, what happens is that this same scalar field, whose potential triggers the exponential expansion, that same scalar field will have quantum fluctuations. And these quantum fluctuations will then be ripped to huge scales, so that quantum fluctuations that have large amplitudes only at small scales normally under normal circumstances would end up being quantum fluctuations of appreciable amplitude at very large scales, where they would then imprint themselves on the initial hot Big Bang. My initial, I should say, is the time when the potential drops, you know, when it decays again. After the expansion has taken place, the potential drops and all of that potential energy goes into the production of particles. And those particles form a hot gas, which is then a hot Big Bang. All right, so under the assumption, and now I'm talking about the not so speculative, but basically currently generally agreed upon model. And that model says that the universe started out with a quasi-exponential expansion, which might have been triggered by a spawning of a daughter universe from a mother universe. So it started out with a quasi-exponential expansion. This, on one hand, led to a flat daughter universe, just because if you think about a balloon, before you inflate it, it's wrinkly. But if you blow it up, it becomes flat. So you get a flat universe, but you get some imprinted fluctuations because of the quantum fluctuations of what's going on. So the overall picture is that we have an explanation for the fundamental observation in our universe that it is almost completely flat. If you take a triangle that's a few billion light years across, the sum of the angles is pretty much exactly 180 degrees. So it's pretty much flat, our universe. And at the same time, it does have a pattern of curvature in it because of the galaxies, the dark matter, and the cosmic microwave background radiation. There are inhomogeneities. So the universe is observationally, we know it is super flat, but it has a particular pattern of inhomogeneities in it. And the theory of inflation explains why it is super flat, because it had this exponential expansion that flattened out everything. But it also has a particular pattern of non-flatness in it, particular pattern of fluctuations on it, which can be explained as having arisen from quantum fluctuations that are normally very small that were ripped to large scales during the exponential inflation. And then the universe was filled with particles when this initial fluctuation of energy was converted into the production of particles. You may wonder, where did this energy come from? So it was just a tiny fluctuation, right? A few Planck scales across, and then the whole thing was exponentially expanded to by dozens and dozens of orders of magnitude to cosmological size. Didn't the energy dilute? No, you see, it's the energy of a scalar field. It's just like the energy of a cosmological constant. It doesn't dilute. You can expand the space underneath it, and it doesn't dilute. The cosmological constant doesn't get less just because the universe is expanding. All right, so what our target is going to be, or one of our targets in our course, apart from black holes and other things, one of our targets is going to be to calculate the starting point for structure formation in the universe. So here we have on the right most panel, we have stars and galaxies. And here is an earlier stage where we would have lots of clouds of gases before they condense into stars and galaxies. And here's mostly gas, just a few stars, and just gas. And here we have a more primordial state where just the initial quantum fluctuations were imprinted as density fluctuations in the very early universe. So our aim is to apply quantum field theory on curved backgrounds, on expanding space-times, and then calculate on one hand for the flattening universe how the quantum fluctuations of the inflaton field behave, and then also how the quantum fluctuations of the metric themselves behave. And in this way, we can then predict the picture that I showed you at the very beginning. Where is it? Here, this picture. So we can then calculate how the temperature fluctuations should be distributed in the cosmic microwave background, and how the polarization vectors should be distributed on the basis of the quantum fluctuations. All right. As I said, I will keep this This is it for today. I will keep this up to date here on the homepage. I will post the lecture notes. I will put a link to the PSR recordings. And if there are any news, I will email them and post them on the website. Do you have any questions? Yes?
So the reason the scalar field doesn't dilute is because it's not dependent on space.
No, we can't say it like that. The big picture is this. If you take matter, like a gas, and space expands, then it dilutes in the obvious way, which is that if you double the volume, you halve the density, right? And so that's obviously how it behaves. If you take a gas of photons, of light, then it dilutes faster than that. The energy density of a gas of light dilutes faster, and that's because on one hand, if you double the volume, you halve the density of the photons, but as the space expands, also the wavelength of the photons gets stretched, and that lowers the energy. So that means matter dilutes one way, radiation dilutes even faster. But at the other, on the other side, you could imagine some kind of other stuff that is not matter, that is not radiation, that dilutes yet differently. And it turns out, in principle, you can do this. There's a so-called equation of state parameter that determines the dilution rate. And in particular, you could imagine some kind of stuff which would not dilute at all. And you could imagine stuff that anti-dilutes. In fact, there's some evidence that the universe might be filled with anti-diluting stuff. You know, dark energy, we don't know what it is, but we know that there's lots of it in the universe. Something like 70% of all the energy is dark energy. And dark energy doesn't seem to dilute. It seems to be of the same kind as, or even the same as, a cosmological constant. It just doesn't dilute. And then it could be that the equation of state parameter is even more extreme. And it could be that dark energy anti-dilutes, which means that the more the space expands, the higher the energy density gets. Now, you might wonder, there's got to be some origin of this. How about energy conservation? Well, the answer is there is no energy conservation. In general relativity, there is no energy conservation. Because energy conservation would require a killing vector field, a time-like killing vector field, which we probably don't have. So our intuition that energy has to be conserved is just not the case in general relativity. And there can be stuff that dilutes faster and slower or even anti-dilutes. And a scalar field just happens to have that by design. Any scalar field has the property that the scalar potential that it has will not dilute. It will behave just like a cosmological constant. Which is why the Dirac fields and of the quarks and the neutrinos can't do this trick. And also the photons can't do it, because they're all not scalar. They're vectorial or spinorial. So scalar fields are special. And so for that reason, the assumption has been brought in that there is a scalar field called the inferton field that does all those tricks. We do know of the existence of one fundamental scalar field, which is the Higgs field. And there's still a chance that the Higgs field is the inferton field, but we're not sure yet. There are some non-fundamental scalar fields. For example, quark-antiquark pairs can form particles called mesons or pions. And those pions would be described by scalar fields. But of course, they're not fundamental particles. They're made out of two more fundamental particles. Among fundamental particles, we know only of the Higgs and the inferton particle. Further questions? Well, if not, then I see you on Friday.